You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Melting Pot is the name of the show, and my name is Michael Barnes. I'm your host for this show. And right now in the studio with me, it is an absolute honor and a pleasure to have Mike Watt here with us. How are you doing, Mike?
Hey, Michael. Thanks so much for having me aboard. Well worth the hell ride from Pedro.
Thank you for dealing with that, right? Especially here in the summer. And you're here. I asked you to come in. Wanted to do this anniversary show for what's one of my favorite records of all time, and just an amazing record, Double Nickels on the Dime from the Minutemen, celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. And wanted to just chat with you about this record, putting it together, and a variety of different things associated with it. And so, again, just thank you so much for coming in.
No problem. My honor.
Could you tell me a little bit about where the band was at when they started getting their ideas together for the new record that eventually became Double Nickels on the Dime?
Yeah. I'll give you a little philosophy.
Okay, sure.
Because the albums was part of this think view we had reevaluated about music after being struck by the punk experience. You understand, we come from arena rock. The first gig we went to was T-Rex. Mm-hmm. When we were 14 years old and never knew about clubs till punk. So when we saw that situation, you know, or was bathing in it,
yeah,
we decided to reevaluate everything.
Hmm.
So we decided to split the world into two categories, gigs and flyers. And everything that was, because the gig was so profound, this idea where, yeah, I could actually be close enough where I could see the bass had bigger strings.
Hmm.
Or the cat you were talking to would be the next guy on stage.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was a whole different dynamic than this kind of circus light show way. I don't want to say much negative about that, but any farmer would tell you if you want a good crop, use a lot of manure. So maybe we were on the right path. So anyway, we come up with this idea. The gig is everything. The only cat in between us and the gig goer was maybe the doorman,
mm-hmm.
who's basically what we can understand with letting he had to deal with the barman. Like, they get the money for the door and they get the beers. So they let that man be in charge. With the taste monitor, he was part of the scene.
Mm.
So there was hardly any filter. It's
yeah.
just how up to you guys to come up, you know, the band dudes to come up with some stuff to reach the people. So we like that. The least toll booths, the least gatekeeper, whatever. So everything else was to get people to the gig.
Mm.
So if you had picture taken or did a spiel, or made a record. These were all flyers to get people to the gig. I know it's almost opposite the idea of
yeah.
you know, promoting a record with, especially in those days,
yeah.
where touring wasn't even an entity unto itself. It was totally part of this promotion. Yeah, gigs, those arena rock gigs were $2, $3, really econo. They wanted it. But we're the other way around.
Mm.
Just the sensibility. Maybe you're a little reactionary against that experience. We want, you know, we reacted against it. We just thought it was great because, yeah, we're going to try and write our own songs. You know, the whole punk thing to us was not a style of music. It was kind of a state of mind. So with this, why not talk about everything? Starting from the get-go, you know, how you put your band together, what's it about? So we're going to make records every 6 months to keep in people's minds. You know, it's like putting another flyer on the telephone pole. Well, here we come in the fall of 83. Minutemen had What Makes a Man Start Fires, Buzz or Howl, The Punchline. We got a few records under the belt. D. Boone's goal was like, we should be able to play anything.
Mm.
Just as long as they could tell it's the Minutemen.
Yeah.
Whatever that meant, you know. When people asked about the lyrics, he used to go thinking out loud. D. Boone had a way of making these econo, you know, in the, I love the knack he had. So we make this album in the fall. We didn't even have a title for it. Got all the tunes together. Of course, recording, you know, was kind of expensive. So you would do downtime, which meant, you know, when nobody's in there, you use tape. You do it like a gig. So it would be in order. You wouldn't have to waste money on sequencing.
Mm.
You know? And we get this thing done. It was the first time we did a whole album with this new guy, Ethan James, who did half of the Buzzer Hal. Mm. He had a compilation. This is a cat in Venice. He actually was on a couple Blue Cheer albums doing keyboard. He said, if you give me a song from my Radio Tokyo tapes comp, I'll do a free song for you guys. Well, we took three of our tunes, put them together, and said it was one. Mm-hmm. That ended up that side. Buzzer Hal, $50. Kaspatsky did the other side live to two track for $50.
Yeah.
So we made that record. So we liked this experience with Ethan, and we come in there, and we didn't even have a title for it. We get done, we did it in 2 days, mm-hmm. end of November. And starting to get a, that was strange, you know, because usually we always started with the title. For some reason, we didn't have one for that out. The Huskers come to town, a Husker dude from Minneapolis, Minnesota, to record with Spots, something called Zen Arcade. They did it in Hermosa Beach there, and we were blown away. We were like, man, we want to make a double album too. So, you know, we write a whole bunch of songs, and then a couple of days in March, we do the other ones. Now, you know, it didn't end up like a record for each session, but I can't even remember what songs were which from a session now, because when it got put together, we'll get into that. But it was totally inspired by the Huskers. Now, they had this whole concept about a boy in a video arcade or something. We had no concept, so we made one up. So to unify this whole thing, Deep Boone really didn't like Sammy Hagar calling himself the Reb Rocker. Huh. And the guy said he couldn't drive 55. So we thought, well, we'll drive 55. And while you make that safe music and drive crazy, we'll make crazy music and drive safe. And so we call it Double Nickels on the Dime. Like, we're going to go right the speed limit. Mm-hmm. Like, you got to pick your fights, you know?
Yeah.
If that's where that guy's going to get his identity thing, okay, we're going to try to do it with tunes and finding our voice and music. No one got that. They thought we were on some kind of road with it. There's all kinds of things about the name. The other thing we came up with was this Omaguma Pink Floyd album. Everybody had a little solo, I think a quarter of an album. Mm-hmm. So each of us went and did a little solo song so we could kind of emulate that. And we thought that was enough binding material to make it a concept.
Hmm.
And that's where the band was. In a way, the band's just putting stuff out there so people be interested and want to see us do gigs. At the same time, motivated by the movement and our peers, like the Huskers.
Yeah.
So in a way, a little bit conscious once the accidents happened, but not so much premeditated from the get-go.
Okay.
Never started out as a double album.
All right. And one of the things I thought about, I sort of knew most of that story in terms of kind of started one way and kind of ended up another way. When did you guys make the decision to add the engine sounds, the car sounds on the record?
Oh, that's Carducci.
Okay.
That ain't us. That's a guy running SST at the time with Mugger, because Greg and Chuck are out with Black Flag Torn so much, they got this cat from originally Chicago via San Francisco to run, and he had this idea. I think he got it from us coming up with this Hagar thing about driving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So not only, you know, we're going to do the speed limit, you're going to get to hear our motors. And, oh, because he kind of combined it. Now I think of it. I've never thought of it before. With the idea of the Amagama thing of everybody having their solo instead of Corva record song.
Uh-huh.
Because here's the sound of my car. But that wasn't a Minuteman idea.
Okay.
You know, some of this stuff, If you look at the credits, there's a lot of other songwriters.
Yeah.
Especially for the second batch of tunes, because we kind of ran out. And what happened was, especially with the music, if you using the same words, we end up with same riffs. So we were, Carducci even, he ends up writing Jesus of Tequila. Hank Rollins, you know, working on Mr. Ginn's pad with D. Boone. He writes Storm in My House. We're just taking Jack Brewer's cousin Joe. We didn't even know this guy. my solo song, because D. Boone said my words were too spacey, so I wanted to get more real. So I used a buddy of mine's landlady's note that said the ceiling was leaking. Don't use a shower.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We had to go outside. So when Carducci brings that, that's, I think in a way it was we felt secure enough as being Minuteman, we could bring in outside guys and still be Minuteman.
Yeah.
See, by that point, it's a high point of the band, especially when I think of the stuff after, like Project Merge, the three-way tie. We were going to try to actually, after three-way tie, that's why there was a ballad in it, because we were going to try to recapture some of that Double Nickels thing.
Yeah.
We as a band at the time knew that was the high point.
Yeah.
But we brought in other people's ideas, too. It was trippy about that. Not stealing. I mean, they brought them in. We weren't plucking them.
It gives the record. I mean, those records from that period of time, What Makes a Man Start Fires, Buzz or Howl, like those records, they like it's clear you guys really like you fully figured it out. Like it sounds like you really have your style and your sound.
Yeah.
And what separates, because those are fine records, but what separates those records from Double Nickels on the Dime is it seems like this record really has a little bit of everything that made the Minutemen the Minutemen.
Yeah,
and I agree. Some of it comes with all the other people who also kind of lend their words or played with your ideas to the record, and it's a record that goes around in a lot of different directions, and that was also something I wanted to ask you about because I feel like sometimes people think about this record like it doesn't seem to have any logic in terms of ways it goes from some very serious political songs to really like kind of philosophical, like existential kind of things, and then there's like some just kind of weird esoteric kind of like jovial just kind of fun. And sometimes the music and the lyrics are really serious, but the music is kind of more upbeat and happy.
Yeah.
And it seems to me, you know, I could see how somebody might think of it as unfocused or just going all over the place. But at the same time, it also seems like Double Nickels on the Dime, more than any other record from the Minutemen, seems like a really tangible representation of how you in a single band, well, especially this band, but a band like this isn't just kind of one thing. Individual people also, we aren't just kind of one thing or focus on one thing all the time. It's like we're able to kind of move in all these different directions. And in that respect, it actually seems to be much more coherent in some ways. I don't know.
No, I agree with you. If you want to know about the philosophy thing, a weird parallel to that, we had done a tour, our first big national tour with Black Flag. They also took us to Europe, first time we'd ever been there. At that time, I was reading Ulysses by Jim Joyce.
Mm.
And like so many of my songs on Double Nickels are totally, I mean, there's one even called June 16th, the day it happens, right? It's also Raymond Pettibone's birthday, my best friend, nowadays. But that really lit a fire in my mind, that book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'll tell you this. When D. Boone, if the ends of his words were going to rhyme, I wasn't going to get it. I got the ones where he would be just jotting things like, you know, psychological means of selling must be destroyed. You know, it'd be little thoughts he'd have, which was kind of what was ignited in my mind by the Joyce book.
Yeah.
But D. Boone had more of a, see, I'm the guy who was really searching for outside lyrics. D. Boone kind of had to for the second batch, but I had to because I felt like, man, this is going to be, I'm a guy who has to start a song with a title to have focus.
Mm.
I feel like I'm doing track homes.
Yeah.
You know, put the garage on this side, the porch on that side. Growing up in Navy houses and stuff, you know, basically track homes are based on barracks.
Yeah.
And I didn't want that in the songwriting, so the lyrics to me were really important. Georgie, too. Georgie was, he'd write him half asleep. He had a job working a lathe really early in the morning, so he'd be like half conscious writing these words. Never had titles.
Yeah.
Just give them to me. I got to title all of his. I think the lyrics really are, like D. Boone said, they're about thinking out loud. And you're right. Anybody who's kind of, you know, awake in the mind is going to think about lots of different things.
Because
the world's entering in, you know, through their eyes, their ears. They're thinking about it. It's kind of an existential thing, very personal thing. But at the same time, I think we had ideas like we wanted some things change. We thought there was inequalities. We thought there was some jive, some. You know, so we also had kind of goals, too, as some way, like a tradition of what he got through you in this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? If I had a hammer, that could be kind of jovial.
Yeah.
That's the way they toss in school, but I wonder. Yeah. I know they got rid of one of his verses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And this land is your land.
Uh-huh.
So I think we were in that tradition, too. So this Joyce. And then, Pettibone taught me about Dada. You know, so we had some things that were way outside our young person thing. But then we also had stuff, I think, put right in us. Remember, we're boys in the 60s.
Yeah.
Okay, so we see people taking issue in the streets with, we got to live up to the promises that's in the papers. We got to deal with this war issue. We got to deal. People really were, what was it called? A participatory mm-hmm. democracy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we get to the 70s when it's our turn. It's all turned into like big chorals for arena rock.
Yeah.
And everybody, some guy up there saying, "Do you feel like I do?" And, wearing a kimono or something and delivering the good time. And we just didn't resonate with that.
Yeah.
And that's why what attracted us, I think, to this movement, this punk movement. Also the humor. They lost their humor. There was something about, very funny about punk that we liked. And that is very, necessary to bring change. Because, to bring change, you have to, people have to figure it out themselves.
Yeah.
So you have to have things, little igniters. You can't give them a series of instructions. Humor's got a lot of that. And just B&D Boom, we weren't supposed to be in a band anyway. We got told that about 10 million times. Luckily, the punk movement, they let anybody up there. It was a little different situation,
Yeah.
So we were used to that. And humor, we had to use as a foil. But punk, it was, anything went. Anything went. But we thought you had to have some kind of integrity.
Mm.
Yeah, that you shouldn't be as jive as the jive, that you're supposed to be reacting against.
Yeah.
So that was the Minuteman mission, the Mission Man, in a way. D. Boomer calls that sometime, the Mission Man. But it was a very autonomous kind of thing, too. I don't know. Emma Goldman, these people had uh-huh. big, strong influences on us, too.
Mm-hmm.
Which was hard to figure out, like watching that movie, The Sand Pebbles,
Okay.
Our favorite movie. We couldn't tell what it was about. We were like that. We would get into things and just there was a feeling about it we dug.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it was resonating off being boys in the 60s.
Hmm.
Yeah, and it going around us and us feeling the, what do you call it, the mood, but not being able to articulate it. But I think that was maybe good, because then we could find our voice and find our way of doing it, not end up being cookie cutter or Xerox.
Yeah. And it also seems to be kind of a perfectly timed kind of moment. Growing up as younger boys in the 60s, early 70s, and then kind of coming of age at the period of time where punk really kind of comes.
You graduate high school, San Peter High, 1976.
Yeah.
I mean, we were just totally lucky.
Yeah, it's like right there.
And get this, there was a cat. He was a Pedro dude. He ended up, found out he was the drummer of the Weirdos, Nicky B. Jeff Avisovich, but they all had different names. And he was wearing a Kotex around his neck, and he said, "Hey, there's a scene where people write their own songs. Show you how lame those days were. Can you believe that being a big idea?"
Yeah.
Because everybody copied. The best dude was the guy who could play, Jimmy Page or something, Jeff Beck. Nobody thought of music in those days as expression. Now, 125 months with the Stooges. I know in the 60s there was a big club scene, and there was all kinds of garage band and, start your own band and jammy kano thing. We were in.
Most people didn't know about
that. Maybe
that
was a lucky thing, too, to be, because the fertilizer thing. Because we were just dumped in a big old tub of it. You're right, Michael. We were very lucky in a lot of ways. The Minutemen are totally a product of their time, in a way. I think Needy Boom played because we're friends. His mama made me play the bass, even. But we wouldn't have been the band we were without the time we were in.
Mm.
I'm not saying we were ripping everybody off and stuff, but we were kind of reeds blowing in that wind.
Yeah.
Also, it being a little scene, because punk was very small, so you have to you had to learn self-reliance. You didn't really rest stuff on approval and validation, because you weren't getting it, man.
Yeah.
They're throwing cups of, you know, their secondhand moisture in your face. And I mean, you know what I mean? So you yeah. had to, in a way, that's a good thing in a way, because you don't have to compromise. That ain't going to help anyway.
Yeah.
You know, we were really lucky. Also, SST had no sound. Every band, there was no branding for that label.
Yeah, everybody.
So that was a good thing. You know, there was autonomy right from the get-go with that label.
Yeah.
And Greg Ginn, you know, we're SST 002. We didn't know these guys. You know, they're 15 miles away. And, yeah, a lot of Hollywood people thought, oh, another beach town. He said, you've been to Pedro? We're Harbor, man. We don't know these guys. But I think the scene was so small, they were handing out flyers for a Pedro gig. We could believe they were going to try and play Pedro like one of their first couple gigs. And they said, why is that? Because we're the only punk band in Pedro. They couldn't believe there was a Pedro punk band. So they said, you want to open? Okay. And then, you know what I mean? The freedom of that situation. And then, yeah, a lot of things added up to that.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like, yeah, like it was all converging. Nobody had managers. It was just dudes doing it.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to say we're more pure, because in some ways we're in the total tradition of Little Richard and Jerry Lee that got kind of lost with the arena rock.
Mm.
So in a way we're kind of a, and maybe before that with Woody Guthrie and the Dada, we're kind of a revival. Somebody once told me the only thing new is you finding out about it. So maybe there's some of that too.
Yeah, maybe. The record, you know, there are other bands on SST had different sounds, but none of them seemed to incorporate so many different genres into their sound the way that you guys did. And there have been times over the years where I've almost, especially with this record, kind of hesitated calling it a punk record. Part of me just wants to call it, instead of calling it what I generally do, which is, in my opinion, the greatest American punk album of all time. A lot of times they'll just call it, you know, one of the greatest American rock and roll records of all time. But at the same time, it really seems like it's important that we consider it a punk album, not because of the style, but more because of the sentiment.
Yeah, well, our belief was punk was not a style of music.
Yeah.
Okay. And here's D Boone, talk about political ideas. D Boone wants to put him in the band. He thought the guitar was too dominating in rock and roll. There was too much hierarchy. He says, how are we going to, you know, ignite some stuff in people's head if the paradigm is the same old, same old? Now, he's the guitar man, so obviously he can act on it the best. So he says, we got to build this like an economy. And I'm not going to play any power chords, and I'm going to play really trebly, because that's what we heard. I had a problem with learning bass. You know, when his mom put me on bass, I didn't know what it was. I saw there was four things. I didn't know it had bigger strings until, yeah, for 2 years I played a guitar with four strings. I mean, I'm talking 14 years old. But so in the R&B, the guitar guys were trebly and they left room for the bass.
Mm-hmm.
This is where D Boone, and that's why James Jamerson, Larry Graham, big influence on. It seemed the English guys would put up the bass in rock and roll, you know, like John Entwistle and Jack Bruce.
Yeah.
And, but over here, it was all muddy. When I met D Boone, the only rock band he knew was Creedence.
Hmm.
So he's got the six Creedence albums, you know, the Grape Juice album, no covers. You got to put five quarters on the needle to keep it from skipping. I can't tell with the bass guy. That's where I got in the flannels. I thought, well, if I wear the singer's shirts, maybe he'll still like me, because I could not tell what this guy was doing. So this is the difference between us in a way from them other guys. We played before punk. A lot of punk rockers, and this is what we loved about them, and why we felt a little tainted and polluted, they learned, like the Urinals, big heroes of ours on the west side here, they started writing songs right when they started learning.
Yeah.
They didn't do all this Blue Oyster Cult T-Rex in the bedroom for, you know, whatever amount of years. So we had some vocabulary.
Mm.
Okay. But we all thought that all that was just motif. They're just vehicles to get a spirit, to get a an expression across. We really got carried away with this idea that music was like expression. Mm. So we never thought of that before. It was like building models. Like, kind of looks like the real thing, yeah. But it ain't, you know. We never thought, I got to get this off my chest. Mm. We never thought of music as being something like that till punk. But then that other side of the definition, we don't think it's a style of music. We think it's a state of mind. So actually, you know, in Pedro, they use that word for people who sleep with people in jail for cigarettes. We didn't understand why someone would call their music this.
Hmm.
Okay, so, yeah. Oh, punk. So, uh-huh. But when we went and saw it, I mean, the first thing I said to D-Boom was, we can do this. You know, we can do this. We can get involved. They'll let us in. It looks like they're letting anybody in. It was empowerment.
Hmm.
And so I let go of that, you know, ridiculous definition that I learned back in Pedro, and like, they just don't fit in, so they're trying to make their own universe. And so that was always the MO of the Minutemen. That's how we saw ourselves as part of the movement.
Mm.
It's strange when you look back, because we actually learned to punk off Hollywood 70s version. The first band to sell out the Whiskey was Screamers. They didn't even have a guitar.
Mm.
You know, it was like synthesizers and Nervous Gender. You know, they had this 8-year-old drummer from Sweden or something, you know. I mean, it was insane. And the fast guitar thing kind of came later with hardcore when it went to the suburbs, because the Hollywood scene kind of burned out. But that's our education. So we end up playing the gigs for the hardcore kids who want a real fast thing to slam do. From this, plus the records come from England. We never saw any of the bands, right? They're just, in fact, we just bought the records by the covers or the names. Nobody wrote about it. We didn't know.
Yeah.
Pop group, okay, try that. You know, look at this cover. They were only $2, so you could, you know, throw the dice. And so our thing was really open-minded. I know the thing became very orthodox and very de rigueur and, not about, autonomy at all, man. Mm. I know the scene. And you say the word, like you're afraid to use the word because it's going to put something in somebody's head.
Yeah.
See, because we come from a different place. And, you know, in those days, a couple years made a way bigger difference.
Mm.
Nowadays, 10 years could go by. It doesn't make the difference like 1 or 2 years meant in those days.
Mm.
I don't know why. You know what I mean? Yeah. Things now don't change as dramatically in with especially with this I wonder about the generation thing, if it ever really did. It seems like a lot of it was just created for marketing, but the actually, you know, the people actually involved taking hands in it, not, yeah, having somebody upstairs just trying to sell you the outfit to go with it.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, I still do Warped Tour things. You know, they get asked to do it. And I remember, yeah, today you're on the Hot Topic stage. And I was like, yeah, D-Boo would like this. You know, it's like, we're going to talk about the Hot. They said, what, man? It's a store at the mall where you buy punk clothes. I couldn't believe it. So you got to understand, Michael, some things are like the title of the records. They're so internalized. I can understand people not getting it.
Yeah.
We had to internalize to keep ourselves together and not rely on other people's definitions. They're going to come up with what they want to.
Yeah.
And they did. And they still do.
Mm.
But, and I think they should be allowed to. But if they want to ask me, I might give them a different opinion than what they're used to.
In thinking about that, and especially all these different kind of ideas and inspirations come to the group and trying to express yourselves. And I think of you and D Boone as being the principal writers. I know George also threw in quite a bit of stuff too. How did you guys
actually George's last, after Double Nickels, he doesn't write any more songs. It's really trippy. Yeah, it was.
Did you ever ask him about that? Why it was case?
Man, we it tripped us out. Well, we thought about Rimbaud, you know, he wrote poems for 3 years and it was over. Some people, I think it's like that.
Huh.
It's not laming out. It's just that's the journey they're on.
Yeah.
Other cats got to do it. You know, they die on stage playing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Elvin Jones, right, had the oxygen tank up there. You know, people come into it different. They go out of it different.
Hmm.
And it was a sad thing in a way because Georgie had a voice. You know, all three of us are from working people.
Yeah.
And we all had, I think, brought to the table different perspectives. We're all firstborn in our families.
Hmm.
Yeah, trippy kind of thing. Georgie was really important, I think. And maybe a problem with a three-way tie for last and Project Mersch. Because we lost his voice.
Actually makes sense. I mean, I don't even know if I'm going to actually use this.
No, you can cut out whatever you want. Sometimes I windbag. So.
But yeah, no. I have that tendency too from time to time. You know, and just in thinking about coming into kind of the discography, this was the first Minutemen record that I heard and flipped out. And actually took me a while to kind of go back and listen to some other stuff and go forward from this record as well and listen to – and the stuff – everything that came after it always felt different to me.
Yeah, it did.
And
me too.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's part of it, just the way that George kind of silenced himself and so there was almost like an element missing.
Yeah.
Huh.
I totally feel that. Because his songs are very key on Double Nickels. But also on Punchline, you know, song the first song, mm-hmm. Search, that's a George Hurley lyric.
Yeah.
The first song on Double Nickels, Anxious Mofo, that's a George Hurley lyric.
Hmm.
He's an important... Well, look, there's this thing that drummers are retarded, you know, because everybody's jealous of the power, because everybody's doing rhythm.
Yeah.
That's why all my bands, we should have done it in those days, all my bands, I put the drummer at the front of the stage.
Mm.
I just hate this. It's another class system. You know, when D. Boone made room for the bass with the trebly thing, he also, me and D. Boone didn't have to teach each other parts because we grew up playing. He'd just play something and I'd play right to him. We spent most of the time teaching things to Georgie so he could have fills. We didn't want just holding the beat. We wanted dialogue. We thought the idea, well, part of it was economy. You put these things together, work, but you're also trying to make interesting conversation.
Mm.
And the drumming's got to be along.
Yeah.
So we always wanted fills and interesting patterns with the toms because they're kind of in there with the... Of course, the kick drum's the closest thing to the bass. But D. Boone really wanted to bring those two instruments up and then bring him down so he'd have a more... Our band would have an egalitarian thing. D. Boone wanted to put political ideas in the band.
In the sound.
This whole idea of the trebly sound. Yeah. It wasn't really to hurt people or be a cheese cutter and cut the top of their heads off. That's what Jay Maskus told me. He saw us and it did him. But yeah, that's what we were trying to do.
Yeah. How did you?
The band is different after this record. That's why I kind of say it was a high point. Almost like a cliff.
Yeah.
Not a mountain like this. You know, up and down.
It's hindsight. In hindsight,
sheer
that's
cliff.
How it
yeah.
Feels.
Not at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you guys actually? Because they're. With these different sides, you know, there's a side for D, you have your side, George has a side, and then there's the final one. There's songs that you all are writing on all these sides. It's not like you just chose a side that was just the songs that primarily one of you wrote. It doesn't seem like that,
no,
that was
it
the
was
case.
A device.
So how did you guys choose where the songs
were? Okay, got the 45 songs. Ethan mixes them in one night. It was on an 8-track, so toms and stereo, kick, snare, that's half the tracks. A guitar for D. Boone, a bass for Watt, a vocal, and then sometimes a lead guitar. That's that one open track. So he didn't have a lot of different tracks to mix. Mm. He mixes all in one night, and Carducci says, if you want to make it for the tour, you got to get it to me quick. And I'm like, how am I going to put 45 songs? Then I thought about the dynamic of those days, vinyl. You got sides. Usually the needle's going to drop on the outside. So why not have the lamer ones hug the label? Now, how do you get the lamer ones to hug the label and the good ones to be on the outside? Well, I thought I'd give each guy a side. We'll pick straws. Long straw gets the first pick. Everybody would pick their favorite songs. Not necessarily the ones they wrote, but what they like. And those would be on the outsides. And then the ones nobody picked, that would go on side chafe, the fourth side.
Huh.
So it was just a way to try to get a sequence because it was driven by sides.
Yeah.
You didn't have to worry about 045 songs in a way. You're talking more about 11 songs. And the hierarchy there, or sequence. Yeah. Good ones on the outside. Not as good, maybe hugging the label. So Georgie won. He got the long straw. He picks a solo song. Now, maybe he did. Maybe he really liked that tune, him whistling and beating on oil cans. Or maybe he thought, you know, George Hurley's time to shine, because look at the title he gives it. It's the only time he ever gave a title to one of his songs. You Need the Glory. So maybe it was Here I Am. And I know, you know, Keith, when you could see some drummers knew the situation and they kind of reacted against it. No, we're just as human as everybody else. We're not dumb because we play drums. Everybody's playing drums, really, on the strings, on the, yeah. So, and D-Boom got second pick. He picked Anxious Mofo, and I think it's because of that guitar solo, because it's so econo. It's just got just the right notes. And, you know, all that stuff's first take, just going for it. And then I got Political Song from Mike Jackson because I never got word back. I sent him, not him, but his management. Well, yeah, him, but via
his people.
The address that was on the thing off the wall. I thought if Mike Jackson sang one of our songs, people would know what the Minuteman was about. Well, I never got word from him. So I thought, okay, maybe Michael here, side what? You know, and then it went from there, you know, bing, bing, bing. And it's actually the guy's favorite song as listeners. I think maybe Georgie picked his song, but and maybe I did too in a way, because I did write that, but I wrote it for Mike to hear it and actually to sing. It wasn't so much me buffing Badge. But I know all the rest I picked because I kind of liked them more than maybe the other ones. And that was the idea. That's how we could get set. And then it would reflect the band's persona. That democratic thing again, you know, participatory.
Yeah.
Here the band's actually picking. It's kind of federalism, though, because they're picking their own sides. You know, you dilute with factions. But that way no one wants the other guy to get too much of the pie. So he's got his kind of thing there. But then he's also expressing his aesthetic. I like this. I like that. So you get to learn a little bit about us. Oh, George Hurley likes this part of the Minuteman. D-Boone likes this part of the Minuteman. D-Boone's solo song was Cohesion, where he just played. Yeah, he ended up picking his. Oh, no, that was. And I ended up picking mine. But mine's way down there by the label. Mine is Take 5D, because I couldn't imagine a song without D-Boone on it. To me, it seemed really weird. And so that's where I read the landlady's note.
Yeah.
But that's how the sequences came out. It was a device to get this thing done in one afternoon.
Was there any consideration of just putting this out as a three-sided record? So it was just kind of like for each member? Or was it after you'd recorded the 45 songs, we're going to put all 45 songs on this?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we should have left off Little Man with a Gun in His Hand.
Why?
Because the better one's on Buzzer Howl. We didn't know how to end it, so it fades out. But even though we play it better, it's not as good. You lose something. You know, good take ain't always playing good. You know what I mean? There's a spirit and a fire. But we were trying to like, we didn't know how to end that, so let's do it again. I wish that one would have been left off. Well, we would have lost Jesus and Tequila. There's some good ones on Side Chafe.
There are a lot of good ones on there.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So maybe it's good it didn't get. But we were thinking of the wheat from the chafe, you know?
Yeah.
That's what D-Boone said. We were like doing the farmer thing a little bit. Because we had the four sides. I think, did the Hooskers put drawings?
I can't remember.
They did on the promo.
It's been a while since
I know that.
It's been a really long time since I saw the original, yeah.
But I thought it was that one, something dreams, reoccurring dreams. It's a big jam thing. Yeah, I think they filled up. As far as the double album goes, that's us totally trying to compete with the Hooskers. You know, we're inspired. So I don't think we thought we had to be double.
Okay.
Like they were double.
Who put the little messages on the inside? Carducci did that too?
And he made those all up. We didn't make any of those up. The Matrix messages. Yeah. The New Pasture.
Yeah.
The Arena Rock and all
that. Arena Rock is Carducci. A new wave. Punk rock is the new nostalgia.
Yeah, we didn't come up with any of that. maybe we shared some of those sentiments, but have you ever read his Rock and the Pop Narcotic? I mean, Joe Carducci is a trip. He's a trip. So, but the way we thought of, we liked the way that scene was, like everybody had a voice.
Yeah.
So if we got a shot at it, why not enable your buddies? Even our gigs, we'd have 1 and 2 minute jams where you have guys run up there with the trumpet and just no song, just jams.
Mm.
They'd run off and we'd get back to our little brief things. We always thought that was part of the movement, was participate. You bring people in. Even though, yeah, Minuteman was pretty, yeah, idiosyncratic as a band. Like, we had this sound, and D. Boone wanted to have a sound, but it was expression of the people. And bringing people aboard, it was part of his philosophy, and which I share with, that's how life is. Life isn't just you and your mind. It's the people you interact with, too. And a lot of it's by accident. And it's kind of a test of humanity, especially with the brothers and sisters, because you don't pick them.
Yeah. And
you know what I mean? Your mom and dad, you don't pick them. So to get along with them is even tougher. Or cats on the street or neighbors. Your friends, you kind of pick, you know.
Yeah.
But they're all tests of the real dealio, which is living together as humans.
Yeah.
And getting it together and treating each other humanely. humanely. Shallow there with the syntax rock. Sorry.
No.
But that's what we're trying to show there, you know. Uh-huh. And that's what I got at the time reading Ulysses. This thing, he's talking about a guy and his wife one day in Dublin, but he's actually trying to talk about everything.
Mm.
That's what Minuteman was trying to do in a strange way.
If I could ask you some questions about some of the particular songs. The number one song I probably wondered about over the years is Maybe Partying Will Help. And this is one that, at least on the notes, you and Dee wrote together. I don't know which one of you wrote the lyrics, but I was just wondering if you could say a little bit more about that song, the meaning behind that song.
Well, I'll tell you right now, Dee Boone never wrote one piece of music to my words. So that solved that mystery.
All right.
He just didn't. I don't know why. Huh. So if you see Watt Boone, you knew Boone wrote the words.
Okay.
And like I said, if it rhymed, Watt wasn't going to get it. It's one of D. Boone's. At the time, he's driving the company. There's Nichols Institute down in Pedro, kind of medical clinic. And he's driving the van, the pool, vet pool. And like the Oceanside, I think they had another thing. So he's got kind of a hell ride, you know, past Pendleton and all that and surfers.
Yeah.
And he's just got a piece of paper there, and he's, you know, I look out, and, you know, and now he didn't title it, of course. D. Boone Georgie never titled the words. They just give them to me. So they're like ruminations in his head. They're observations.
Mm-hmm.
That's all the kind of words I got from D. Boone. I never got the, you know, but they're good. I like them. And they really helped me with the songwriting. But like, this ain't no picnic, Corona, I'm not going to get words like that, you know, that rhyme at the end. But I still think they're, for me, they were empowering. They're, you know, and he had a knack, like I was telling you before, of saying it simple, what I was feeling.
Yeah.
And I didn't use this without the spaced out language that I can't be blessed with. And so that's what where the words are, and that is. He's looking at the situation. D. Boone's like this a lot of times. He's looking at things, and he's thinking out loud. The music, you know, I'm feeling some kind of Bootsy thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And also, man, that stuff lit Georgie up, man. He was a hi-hat man, you know? Yeah. What's, I asked about kick drum because it's the closest note to the bass. He goes, man, that's just something I throw in between. Georgie's a hi-hat man. So I thought musically I could get him going on that. And then the toms and all that. And then have dynamic. Because the song to me seemed like, and a lot of Minutemen's this way, it's not one groove.
Yeah.
Starts, stops, this and that, and this and that.
Uh-huh.
And then getting self-critical. Getting self-critical. Right? If you want to change, change yourself.
Yeah.
That was a big part of the Minuteman with ever saying that. So it wouldn't be all didactic and stuff.
Yeah.
We thought hopefully people would get that from the tunes. And that tune for sure. And that's why I picked up on it.
Yeah.
Because there's things we got to do. But it's up to all of us to be a part of this, the thinking and come up with good ideas about it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not, we weren't so much in the idea of the little vanguard thing. We were like, you know, if everybody thought about, if everybody, we have so much common ground, but yet so much individually, you know, just around the thumbprint, I'm pointing a thumbprint, people, here. At the same time, it's the dangling duality. Mm. But it's also a strength, because all, we all got different perspectives, and I think we can all bring something to the party.
Yeah, yeah.
Partying didn't really mean just getting wasted in that tune. It meant bringing things together. Yeah, was it supposed to? And then that thing at the end, you know, with Georgie on the tom and D Boone going off on the lead guitar. I just wanted to hear. Sometimes I would do things, and when I set up my songs, just to see what would happen with those guys. There's one line, it's got a big cuss word in it. It's expected I'm gone.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with the song. I just wanted to hear D Boone say that. Sometimes, you know what I mean? Sometimes my songs seem like little plays for me. You know, I only wrote one song as a kid. It's called Mr. Bass, King of Outer Space. It was about, because I was starting to realize, whoa, yeah, bass is, you know, it's right field in Little League. This is where you put the retarded friend. And I was like, so this song's about playing a big bass solo and blowing everybody off stage. It was like, obviously some issues with the inferiority complex. You know. So when I get to writing songs, you know, with punk movement and stuff, I'm putting on little plays. And D Boone and Georgie are my chief stars, you know, in these things. And I would like to set up things and see, because they were like, they had a natural thing about getting their personality out that I just loved.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what that tune's there about. It's me dealing with D Boone, trying to share with people D Boone thinking out loud, and then musically really trying to work a kind of a funky dynamic with George Hurley. And then D Boone's lead guitar was strange. It was a mixture of Buck Dharma from Blue Oyster Cult and John Fogerty from Creed.
Yeah.
And then his rhythm guitar was a little Pete Townsend. Yeah, it was strange because we learned off the records, you know?
Yeah. A couple songs that you wrote, My Heart in the Real World.
Right.
And I just wanted to read this, the lyric, at least the way the lyrics were printed out. I think for the most part, there's sometimes where D kind of adds a couple words or changes things around, and I don't know if that was something that he just did in the moment.
Some of these were so last minute.
Yeah,
I can hear the paper that he's holding, like Mike Jackson. He goes organizing the Bosquets for murder. It's the first time he's ever read them.
Yeah.
So some of these things especially the March 84 session.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we're just trying to get these babies out there.
Okay. For this song, this is the lyrics to the song, and it, you know, it reads like a lot of the stuff you were writing at this, you know, period of time, you know, reads very poetically. And so My Heart in the Real World, written by Mike Watt, it's on this record, Double Nickels on the Dime. And so my soul collapsed into the big guilt wad. Some big thunder law forces me to eat shit. And if I was a word, could my letters number 1,000? More likely coarse and guttural, one syllable Anglo-Saxon. And then the second verse is, I'm a victim of a fact. Let's say I loved a girl, but the world was wrong, and I was made to march in line. Finally, I felt like handcuffs. Machines disregard my pronouns. I am defeated. I am the cold, damp clay. And I was wondering just there are multiple themes that are going on in that song. And in some ways, actually seems really related to maybe partying will help in some respects. But I was wondering if you could shed a little light on what was going on in My Heart in the Real World.
That's my reaction to one of my reactions to Ulysses, James Joyce. Mm. It was, you know, I'm 25 at that time, and I read this thing. I'm totally reacting to this thing like some people reacted to On the Road, you know. And, yeah, because I thought, you know, especially with Molly giving the big spiel at the end, it was about a guy and a girl in a way. But in another way, it's about everything.
Yeah.
And that's my version of it. And there's no topical connection except for me reading that book and getting finished with it just right before we write these tunes. Yeah, I really like books and paintings to influence me because you don't have to worry about ripping off another music guy. You have to abstract it, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas if you listen to another song, uh-oh, there's He's So Fine and My yeah. Sweet Lord.
Yeah, yeah. Was that kind of a similar influence with The World According to Nouns?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Almost every lyric I write on this one, except Mike Jackson. Mike Jackson, I really thought if he sang those words, people would know what the Minutemen were about.
Do you know if he ever actually heard it?
I don't know. I never got word from the management. But that one was totally designed. It was the mission, you know, a flyer right into his mailbox slot, you know, like, hey, sing this for us and people will know what we're about. Because I just, his voice, you know, and the way, just the way he presented himself. I don't know. It's just political song from Michael. It's not an ironic title.
Yeah.
It's totally
I think
what
a lot
is.
Of people might think that.
Oh,
but,
everybody
but,
does. Nobody yeah. thinks it was the real thing. When I tell them that, they're like, are you kidding me? No, I'm not kidding you. I've really thought, because at the end of the day, music's music. Mm. That's what we thought. It's all vocabulary.
Yeah.
And just because one cat's in one realm and another cat's in another, we just come from different places and we're on different paths, but music's music. And but my words are so influenced by that because I just finished it. Yeah. And it was kind of hard to figure out. And I just was wondering about it. So much of Watt lyrics on Double Nickels is tied to that.
Yeah. With the album, because you only... Like you don't, well, I guess you sing on Politics of Time, but the other tracks that feature your voice more prominently are more kind of more spoken as opposed to sung.
Yeah, it was too hard. The bass line was too hard. I was supposed to do History Lesson Part 2.
That's what I was getting ready to ask you about.
That's why D. Boone changed it to me and Mike Watt because it sounded kind of retarded.
Yeah,
me and D. Boone.
Yeah, because you know, I mean, that's for me when I hear this record. You know, just because D sings on virtually all the tracks, and so it's like a lot of times when someone is singing the song, it's like their voice. It seems like the song is in their voice. It's like it's their song, as opposed to you know might have written it or somebody else wrote the lyrics. And so there are a lot of songs on this record that are kind of associated. I'm talking about when I first heard it when
no,
I was
a lot
like
of people,
9, 10 or whatever.
It's all first
you know,
person. Like
really,
D.
just thought about them as being. These songs
yeah.
and wasn't until later probably when I was in college where I really kind of noticed the distinctions between how the differences in the ways that the two of you and also George how you guys would write songs with really distinct voices didn't matter who was singing there's a really distinct voice
yeah,
with
there,
each of them
is.
And
part of it's pragmatic on the bass
okay
the record before that is Buzzer Howe. That's the last song I use a pick.
Mm.
I go to fingers. I finally can play fast enough to play with my fingers. There's only one song on Double Nickels I play with a pick. It's called Shit from an Old Notepad, which was an old notepad. It's again, D. Boone writing thoughts out. But I played it with a pick. All the rest are with the fingers. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do both at the same time like I did on the other records more.
Mm.
And... So, like, there's Politics of Time, Take 5D, the comedy song covers Steely Dan, Dr. Wu. That's it. It's all D. Boone. Because D. Boone, a lot of times, he just laid out when he sang. He didn't even have to play. He liked that. Or just mute the strings and, you know, like playing washboard.
Yeah.
Yeah, where he wanted the bass to pump. He didn't like it dropping out. You know, so I couldn't do... Like what he did like that. And that's another practical thing.
Okay.
But I wrote these things for these guys, especially with their own words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Georgie's words or D. Boone's words. I wrote it so they could inject their personality in them.
Okay.
You know, I thought it was really important because to have passion is really how to make music, I think.
So when you wrote History Lesson, you wrote it. Your words, but you were kind of writing it with, you know, Dee is going to sing this
not,
at some
not
point.
First.
Was that the case?
First I tried and it was like, man, this is stumble. Yeah. Actually, I got the idea from Velvet Underground, if she ever comes now. That's one of the few songs that I wrote on a guitar. I can't play guitar very well, but I wrote that one on guitar. And I was kind of influenced by that. That song has nothing to do with Ulysses. That song has to do with maybe the hardcore kids. There started to be a big war in the Flip Side magazine between kids liking our band and another band and who really was punk and who was really.
Yeah.
And I was trying to say, you know, we're all in this, you know. We all come from different places. Nobody picks any of this stuff. But we're supposed to be getting over those kind of things because look at this big, mean world outside there.
Yeah.
And here we're mirroring that same dynamic. So don't worry. It's you and your buddies playing. Me and my buddy playing. I dreamed I was another guy playing. That's how I got into playing, you know, or got enough nerve up to do it. It was kind of like, yeah. When Pete, what was that guy? Mayor Baba? His buddy, his guru guy?
I don't know.
Well, when he found it, he woke up one morning.
Yeah, I know. I can't.
Mayor Baba was his name, I think.
Okay.
And he woke up one morning and realized he was God, so he wasn't going to talk anymore. But on his deathbed, he told Townsend, don't worry, be happy. You know, they made a song out.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of got that vibe in a way. Not so infantile and mamby-pamby, but I was trying to tell those hardcore kids that we're with you. Yeah, we wish you experiment a little more with the motifs, but we understand where you're at. We're not going to school and having to fight jocks and stuff. We all got a heavy thing on us, but we all come from this place of disenfranchised. I felt punk people came from disenfranchised situations.
Yeah.
And we shared. Even though we're not born, we're not in the same town, we're sharing in a way.
Yeah.
And because history lesson, it's also a continuation of history lesson part one off Punchline, where Dee Boone sings about kind of cynical, right? Humans fight humans over power, you know?
Yeah.
It's crazy. I try to show there's another, you know, that's a big human component, but maybe there's another one that's got this kind of a compassion, trippy way. And that's why music is kind of good fabric to connect us.
Yeah. And right from the beginning, and it's, you know, one of the iconic lines from that song, but right from the beginning, that kind of appeal to community comes out, you know, just with the Our Band Could Be Your Life
line. Community. You know? That's great, Michael. That's what it was.
Yeah. But it's also such a deeply personal song, too.
It is.
And
because, remember, I'm not a musician. I get into music to be with my friend.
Yeah. And for me, because by the time I got introduced to the Minutemen, Dee Boone was already gone. So I never had a chance to see you guys. I don't, you know, I was like 10 years old when he died. So I don't know if I would have even been able to go to clubs in Atlanta around that time. But but certainly if the, you know, band had played on, I would have had that chance. But for me, there's always a kind of sadness associated with the song now. I mean, especially just almost there's almost kind of like a bit of nostalgia connected to it as well, because there's this reflection of where you guys started and the fact that basically it's kind of the same. It seems kind of the same to me as a listener. Like, it's always been, you know, you and Dee Boone, you know, just playing around in the band.
Yeah.
And that just that statement of friendship and the way it ends with, you know, well, he changes it to, you know, me and Mike Watt playing guitar. You know, it all almost always brings me the tears. It's just the sentiment in the song is just a really beautiful sentiment. And I always thought that the story of the friendship of the three of you, but especially you and Dee Boone, was just such a powerful and amazing story of friendship. And something that I feel like those kind of stories and that kind of closeness between people is something that that we don't hear nearly enough about. It certainly occurs between others, but it doesn't seem like it gets expressed.
Well, we thought that scene enough. Was open enough you could do that. Mm. That's how much confidence. By that time, by 1983, you could let the freak flag fly.
Mm.
I don't know why. There's a lot of confidence that we found through the scene that comes out in Double Nickels. We could do anything. And we're going to talk about all these other things. I thought we got to talk about this. I just felt compelled. And T-Boone had no problem with it. You know, there was, you know what I mean? There's no fear.
Yeah.
If we're going to talk about these other things. Otherwise, here comes the jive again. The stuff we're supposed to be fighting.
Yeah.
We're really conscious of that. If you want to change, then have integrity. So we had to put that out there. I mean, he didn't have a discussion with me. Okay. Bring on the soap suds. Bring on the schmaltz. Why? He didn't do that. It was just a natural thing, and it was actually me thinking of those other kids.
Yeah,
and relating to them. So, yeah, they were pretty distant and alien to us in a way, but there were still things I thought that connected us. Mm. Music is a bit thing about that. Transcend, huh?
Yeah.
Realities.
Yeah.
I know there's something about keep it real, but. You know, which bayou was John Fogerty born on? A very northwest one, like 1,500 miles.
Yeah.
You know, and the same thing. I thought we could share something with them guys.
Yeah.
And it's we can have different sounds and be in different bands and still be together. And, yeah. This is me and my buddy. You're with you and your buddies. The last shift was that way. This shift, the next shift will be that way. It's okay. It's not, it's one of the things that's kind of neat.
Yeah.
And I wanted to share that. Now, yeah, I tried to do it and I couldn't. So, T-Boone, please do this for me. And maybe change. And he said, don't worry. I was already thinking that. Okay. I'll put me and Mike Watt.
In thinking about this record, especially here on the 30th anniversary, I wonder what you feel the legacy is of Double Nickels on the Dime and maybe also the legacy of the Minutemen.
Yeah. Well, what T-Boone liked to say, start your own band.
Mm.
Another thing he said, punk is whatever we made it to be. We were true believers in that sense. You know, when they said let the freak flag fly, we were into it.
Hmm.
We're into it, and we were going to try to show that by example. And I think that's a legacy. That's why I let Tim and Keith do that Jammy Cano documentary.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't just trying to say we were the best band. Right? I thought if people saw that thing, then anybody would try to start a band if they saw that we did it. I think that's the thing. I think the Minutemen owed a debt to the scene.
Yeah.
They let us take that thing we had in the bedroom doing the Creedence and let us come out and do it for people. And we wanted to hand that down. You know, which we found out later, yeah, Woody was doing the same thing. And we're linking this chain.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the Minutemen's legacy isn't by itself. It's part of another legacy. It's important that each time those people find their voice to add to it. But it's kind of a chorus. And kind of echoes. And then kind of a portent of what's ahead. A little bit. As far as hope.
Yeah.
So that's why I think about the Minuteman. We're a product of a movement who's way into the O word opportunity rather than the B word burden.
Hmm.
Even though didn't have a lot of material,
mm-hmm.
you could still get with your buddy, try your hardest, and try to find that voice inside you. And we were given that opportunity. And, put it out there. Like what the Huskers did, you know, be an enabler.
Yeah.
Or an instigator or something.
Hmm.
Yeah, we would have never done Double Nickels if they wouldn't have done that. But it wasn't a competition, you know?
Yeah.
It was like, yeah. Yeah, why not try that? They tried it. Why don't we try it? That's what it was. That's what it is. I still try to operate that way. There's nothing more dangerous than a good idea. And, yeah. You know, in the moment, those days were all about the moment. We never thought. You know, it was flyers and gigs.
Yeah.
Now I look at it as a work. Like now, I can hear D. Boone play. I don't, because he can't do the gigs. Yeah, we thought it was a mistake we were even getting to do this. We knew we were running out of time. I didn't know it was going to end that way, but
yeah,
so we were trying to pack it in. Yeah.
Hmm.
So maybe there's a little earnestness in the Minutemen legacy, I think. But man, all those cats and all the other guys, yeah, there was something about it, man. It was like a flannel, you know, a lot of good fibers making up the whole, some of the parts thing. And it's strong on me. This third opera I did is very much informed by that record. All these years later. And I had to, in fact, what I did, I wrote it all on D. Boone's guitar. I was so afraid. I wouldn't even let the guitar and drummer hear the bass parts or the spiel parts when I taught him the parts. Yeah, I put them on after. They were surprised. But I thought, hey, you don't want it too much Minuteman. Get rid of the only Minuteman. But that record is heavy on me. But at the same time, nostalgia, right? You don't want it Fonzie and Potsy stuff. You know, that'll foul it up for good. I remember my pop when that TV show came out. He goes, you know what? Boy, those were not happy days. And things aren't like that. But that time when we made that, it was just something about the band. I don't know. It's coming around. Especially, like I said, not so much like a mountain, more like a cliff, because after that, it's really different.
Yeah.
It seems like all the records before that are adding up to it. So there's something about that.
Yeah.
Like arc.
Yeah.
And I'm just very grateful for D. Boone and Georgie playing their hearts out and not being, you know what I mean? No bummed out and just connecting the dots. Just, that's a big part of it, too. These guys just going for it, man. And not being all self-important. Just doing it, getting it out there. Incredible thing for me, you know. I couldn't listen to that stuff until I did the Wee Jammy Kano, because they were going to talk to me and I had to remember. I hadn't listened to it in years and years.
Yeah.
And then when I heard it, it was like, whoa. Yeah. And it all came back to me. They're all little diary entries too, in a way.
Yeah.
Remember all the practices, all the thing getting to it. It's very personal for me. It's so interesting how people relate to it. Told you we had to build that thick skin where we didn't even care what people thought. But it really amazed me. And like you said, you were only like 10, and you can relate to it.
Yeah.
Wow. That's quite a compliment to us.
Yeah. And it's a record, you know, it's one of my favorite records. It's one of my favorite records to suggest to people. Many of the songs are songs that I enjoy putting on, well, used to, when I made tapes, used to enjoy putting them on tapes for people and you know, just the ability of the songs, because there's so many different ways that the songs go. You know, there's a lot of flexibility in terms of what you can kind of bring into the mix as a DJ, or I wasn't even really a DJ when I was originally doing that, but kind of like proto DJ-ness before I started really getting into this. Just that ability to kind of make connections, you know, to a variety of different places. And it's clear from the music that you guys listened to prior and were listening to at the time, is, you know, a lot of those connections kind of find their way into the music too.
You know, a lot of people, okay, there was a lot of characters, but they were deep into music. Pettibone playing me Coltrane. I thought he was playing punk. I thought he was a little older. I didn't know he was dead. You know, Navy Houses, I didn't know what bebop was. And
yeah.
Me and D. Boone, Georgie, our minds were blown by all the musics. that arena rock was so narrow.
Yeah.
Maybe a foundation to learn some, you know, rhythms and some scales. And but when these cats from the scene got us into, they were deep about music. That's what's funny, because at the same time, they're very provocative and a lot of exhibitionism. And but they were also dudes that were big lovers of music. It reminds me of like Vincent van Gogh. Not an insane man. He's incredible. Maybe he's had some troubles, but huge fan of art. He tried all those styles. Went through all that stuff. He got bit. And I think that's what happened to us.
Mm.
Yeah, we were just like, it's all rhythms and stories, melodies, plays, little scenes, setting up scenes. There's this idea where you could create, but have it relevant because it's part of cultures.
Yeah.
So it's not total, you know, self-serve thing. We're connected to the world. It's the way guys like us connected. Because in a lot of ways, this is another thing about Georgie. You know, Georgie is very popular at high school. And for him to play with us, man, his friends were like, what? But he wanted to play. And it was amazing. It was amazing. You know, he didn't care that we were the weirdos and insane. Yeah, I put Richard Hell on my bass, man. That was like a line in the sand. And now Georgie wants to play with us. His, all the Pedro people. Whoa. So in some ways, he felt like an outsider too, even though he was very popular in high school and made his own surfboards.
Yeah.
You know, he got rid of the shed, turned from surfboard making thing to drum prac room. Because that's Minty Boone, no place to play with drummers. So we were always looking for guys. In fact, the first Minutemen drummer was a welder guy who lived in a little house in his sister's backyard. Yeah, you can't play in the apartments, you know, so we were always looking. In fact, when we were first putting together the Minutemen, Joe Biza lived downstairs. Now, we saw this guy at gigs. We didn't really know him. He's Wilmington. He moved to Pedro. And we worked out the first batch of Minutemen songs without amplifiers. So we're holding the beat with our feet. Now, he can't hear the guitars. There's no amps. He thought we were, like, dancing with each other for 4 or 5 hours a day.
That's funny.
So, you know what I mean? In a way, and I think there's some of that kind of thing, you know, where people kind of don't fit in. That helps a little bit.
Yeah.
You know? Unless, yeah, bullying, and then people, they don't find an artistic outlet, and they get back in crazy ways.
Yeah.
We were trying to get back. See, I think because of that 60s thing going on where we were boys. No, the thing, revenge is not the thing. You just got to bring good ideas. You got to improve the culture with the inclusiveness. Mm-hmm. Even though, yeah, because all the exclusives, us being shut out, those were just corny, you know, jive, trendy things. People are peeking in high school anyway. I mean,
yeah.
Come on, you know, so we didn't want to, I'm glad we never got on that revenge kind of thing. But we were kind of outsiders, but especially when we found out about these beats and dadas and bebops and all these things were kind of outside movements. There's a whole tradition of, even in England, I found out about these rebel songs from 400 or 500 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's traditions of this stuff all over the place. So it's, you know, you're catching some of the resonance. And even though we're only 25 when we make that record, we're catching on to some of that pretty heavy. And it's people in the movement. A lot of it's listening to Pettibone. He's the great educator. He's the great informer. He was something else. But everybody, all those cats. You know, the Germs drummer Don Bowles. I mean, that guy, he knew about every band in the world. Byron Coley. These were deep on us, these people. There's something about an underground. Of course, we weren't into elites and that, and it's one reason why we stayed in Pedro. So it was like a thermos bottle.
Yeah.
Close enough to play in Hollywood.
Yeah.
I remember one time somebody told us, man, why don't you move? That's where everything's happening. And T. Boone says, what are we going to write songs about? Hollywood. So that ended. That discussion was over.
Yeah.
It was a trip. It was a trip.
Yeah.
But we never had anything against anybody who was here. We loved playing up here. Loved hanging with those cats. They were trippers, man. They were the ones that gave us confidence that you could let the freak flag fly.
Yeah.
Guys wearing a garbage sack and speaker grills for eyeballs. Okay. You know, singing about, the things they sing about. I mean, that whole movement was so empowering. Not to get nostalgic or anything, but just to show you that didn't come out of anywhere.
Yeah.
And then the Square John world, too. It being so like, you know, to hell with you guys. That helped it, too. The one way I tried to keep from, you know, doing a nostalgia sentimental thing with my third opera was I'm going to make it about a middle-aged punk rocker because Minutemen would have never... We didn't know what that was.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So life's a journey. I would never be the cat I am now without that band, without that experience. It's just really profound on me. So for you to share in on that, thank you so much, Michael.
Well, you know, again, I can't thank you enough just for sharing this time with us and the stories and giving a little bit of a kind of a glimpse into that very specific period of time and just the way that you've carried it with you and all the things you've done since then. And again, just sharing it with us today. I can't thank you enough. Thank you so much, Mike.
Big welcome. Thanks for having me aboard.